Today from the Wings Archives, Battered Women's Syndrome.
In my professional opinion, Abby Hicks was a battered woman in her relationship with her husband, Tom Hicks.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Dr. Lenore Walker is a forensic psychologist who testifies in courts of law on behalf of women who have killed abusive husbands. As she explained to reporters in Kansas City, she originated the battered women's defense.
Actually, my involvement with battered women came well before my involvement with battered women in court. I had begun to do some research into battering that arose out of my work at that time at Rutgers Medical School, where we were beginning to deal with some child abuse issues. And of course, this is back in the early 1970s. I considered myself then one of the early feminist therapists. And I was beginning to see women who would come in and tell me that they were being battered. I was shocked. I mean, I did not grow up in a home where there was that kind of abuse, and I didn't understand it. So I went to the literature, and what I found in the literature was so awful that I decided I had to do my own research. So I started talking to women who had been abused, and as I began to gather more and more information, I got more and more intrigued, and then was awarded a research grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to study the psychology of 400 battered women. And that's really was the first major study of learning what the psychological effects of battering are on women. I was then asked to present in 1977, even before the research project began, I was asked to present at a conference in Seattle. 500 people in the conference, and somebody said to me after I made this, what I thought was a wonderful speech, Dr. Walker, everything you say makes great sense, but it's long-term social change. Women are dying every day. What are you going to do about it? So I responded, forgetting that there might be press in the audience. Very quickly, I said, well, no woman should have to die if she has to defend herself and even get to the point that she has to kill him in order to defend herself. I'll help provide a defense for her. Now, I had been in court twice up until that point, once to get a divorce and once to pay a traffic ticket. I had no idea what I was saying. But the next morning, the newspapers, headlines all over, because a wire service picked it up, battered women specialist will defend women who kill. And so I became... that was the specialist in the area. By the time I got home, back to Denver, my first lawyer's call was in, and I had to admit that I didn't know what I was talking about. And so I said to the attorney, look, you know, I was just answering a question. I had no idea anybody would do this. And the attorney said to me, do you know anything about the psychology of battered women? And I said, well, it's 1977. There's not a whole lot to know. What there is, I know. He said, fine. You teach me about the psychology of the battered woman, and I'll teach you what you need to know about presenting it in a court of law.
Since it was first used, the battered women's defense has been successful in courts across the United States and in some other countries. Lenore Walker herself has testified in 220 cases where a woman was charged with first-degree murder. Two-thirds of those women served no time in jail, and none served more than 2.5 years. As Dr. Walker points out, only a tiny minority of the 3 to 4 million U.S. women who are abused each year kill their husbands. Usually, they feel nothing else will stop him from killing them. Walker says most abused women have a psychological pattern called learned helplessness, which can arise from experiences in childhood, like seeing their mothers abused or being beaten themselves. Oddly enough, those are the same factors that most often cause men to become abusers.
A man who watched his father beat his mother is 700 times more likely to beat somebody in his own home, use violence in his own home. If he also was beaten, he's 1,000 times at risk. Any other disease that somebody was at 700 or 1,000 times at risk, we would be beating down the research centers. to do something about eliminating it. And yet, because violence is a gendered issue, because it's more women who, and children who are the ones who are victims, and more men who have more power who are the abusers, I believe we don't do enough. We don't take it seriously enough. And yet I think it's been demonstrated it's probably one of the greatest causes of death in this country.
When Lenore Walker testifies in court, she spends hours educating the jury about the psychology of abuse. She demonstrated parts of her testimony at a mock trial before legal and psychological professionals in Kansas City. We excerpt from that testimony here.
In psychology, we often think that what happens to you as a child magnifies what happens to you as an adult. We did some statistical analysis and found that you didn't have to have learned helplessness to be just as able to develop learned helplessness from just relationship factors as an adult. You can take a normal, healthy person who had a normal childhood, put them in a battering relationship, and they will develop the learned helplessness factors. Now, these seven factors, the first one is that the violence occurs in a recognized pattern. And there are two specific ways to measure that pattern. One is that there's a cycle, and the violence almost always escalates in the relationship, almost always gets worse over time. The second factor is that there's sexual abuse in the relationship. And in my experience with the women that I've testified and evaluated who have killed somebody in what they claimed was self-defense, sexual abuse is more frequently present than even in the general population of battered women. And our data suggested that over 50% of the women have also been sexually abused. The third factor is what I call power and control issues. There are several parts to that. The first is that there's usually pathological jealousy, and that's usually on the part of the man towards the woman. Sometimes it's mutual, and it's also from her to him. The second is that there's overpossessiveness. The man tries to possess the woman. He wants her to only pay attention to him, and he uses a variety of power and control tactics to get his way. The third is what we call intrusiveness. The women describe these men as wanting to take over their whole life. They want to know everything, what they do, where they go, what they think, what they wear, everything about them. And they don't want to share the woman with anyone, including children. And then the last part of that power and control factor includes isolation. And isolation is a big issue for battered women, where the men try to isolate them, often using very subtle tactics, even before they begin their physical abuse, trying to drive wedges between her and her relationships with other people, perhaps telling her that her parents don't really love her very much because of wrongs that she may have felt hurt about what they did, finding fault with their friends, not letting them go out places without them, finding many ways to trap them into that sense of isolation. So that's the third factor. The fourth one are threats to kill, both direct threats and indirect threats. And again, in most of the cases that I've worked on where a homicide occurs, the threats to kill often have a direct, overt quality by certain actions, such as being choked and weapons being used to threaten her with. The fifth factor I call psychological torture. Now, this was a difficult one for those of us who were doing research to be able to measure. We had to find a way to separate what would be considered the normal psychological meanness that we do to one another when a relationship is no longer a good one, the kind of nastiness that people do to one another, from actual psychological abuse. And I finally settled upon the definition of psychological torture from Amnesty International that's used for our prisoners of war and battered women are often treated much like those prisoners of war. And as you can see on the chart, there are 9 factors in that definition, and those include verbal degradation, name-calling, really being made to feel that you're not worthy because of all the names and the way he talks to you. Denial of powers, telling her that she's not good at anything, telling her she's a bad housewife, she's a lousy mother, she doesn't do things the way he wants her to do them, always picking, super critical of her. The third one is isolation, and I talked about that before. The fourth is monopolizing her perceptions. That's part of the intrusiveness, the way he tries to take over what she thinks and tries to be the only one to supply her with information. The fifth one is called hypnosis or mind control. It's a way of intensely focusing on him and what he wants, that it almost is akin to the hypnotic effect that happens with our prisoners of war. The next one is threats to kill, and I've talked about that. The next one is called induced debility. That's really making somebody's body less strong. And a very common way in battering relationships is to wake her in the middle of the night and pick a fight. Make her listen to long harangues of harassment in the middle of the night so she can't sleep, sometimes not letting her go to sleep. Oftentimes there's also induced debility by food deprivation of some kind. Sometimes the man doesn't let her buy proper food or eat as much as she wants. Sometimes it becomes her own choice because she's so anxious and so nervous that she can't eat. Next are drugs and alcohol. The use of drugs or alcohol to control her, to make her weaker. And then the last one is occasional indulgences. And when I talk about the cycle, I'll talk about how that works in a particular pattern for battered women. Now the sixth factor is called violence correlates. And here there were 4 specific other kinds of violence that the woman knows that the man has engaged in that makes her more frightened of him. And those 4 are knowledge that she has about his violence against other people, about his violence against children, his violence against pets, sometimes even plants, things that she treasures that he will destroy. And then the last one, violence against the property, being so angry that he punches holes in the walls and the doors or whatever. And then the last, the 7th factor, is the alcohol and drug abuse. In our research, we found that almost 2/3 of the men drank to excess, drank alcohol to excess. The 2 forms of drugs that we found the highest association with violence was cocaine and methamphetamine. And I think if we did our research today, we would find crack cocaine at one of the higher levels for increasing the levels of violence. The more factors, of course, that are present, the more likely the woman has developed learned helplessness, which means the more likely it is that she has lost the ability to predict that what she does is going to have a predictable outcome. Doesn't mean she doesn't do things, but she has to move to the highest level of predictability in terms of her actions. So, for example, in a case where somebody might pick up a weapon to defend herself, if a woman has learned helplessness, she may have learned that using something less then the weapon won't stop the violence.
Dr. Walker's testimony includes charts based on her extensive research on battered women. Here she points to 2 graphs, a typical cycle of violence followed by an escalated cycle of violence in which someone may get killed.
If you look at the chart, the horizontal line is time, and the vertical axis is the amount of tension, or as it gets higher, the perception of danger that a battered woman has. And the first parts, the tension building period, you see just little incidents. Each time there's a little incident, the woman feels a certain amount of tension, and then the incident stops. She may have done something to stop it. He may have just stopped it on his own. And the tension goes down just a little bit, but not all the ways back to the horizontal line that's zero. And then there's another incident, and that goes up a little bit more, and again, until we reach that top part, which is the period of inevitability. That's the point at which, if you don't separate the couple, there will be an explosion. That tension simply has to go somewhere. And that explosion is the second phase, or the acute battering incident. Most of the injuries, if they occur during the battering episodes, occur during the acute battering incident. And in fact, most of the time that law enforcement are involved, it's usually at the acute battering incident. And oftentimes, there isn't the benefit of understanding the cycle and the tension building period that got people to that point in the first place. I might also add that women who fight back often get hurt worse. That tends to escalate the violence. Now, some women fight back because they say it's a way of protecting their mind. He can hurt their body, but he can't get their mind totally. And so sometimes, just for their own self-respect, they fight back, even knowing that they may well get hurt worse. And that's particularly true for urban women who have grown up kind of in an atmosphere where they have to defend themselves. So they may look very tough on the outside and be marshmallows inside. Now then we have at the end what we call the third phase, or loving contrition. Now in a psychology theory, this is the reinforcer. This is what keeps women in the battering relationship, because here is where the man says he's sorry, promises in some way, even if he doesn't use those words, that he'll never do it again. And also, this is the point at which she remembers the first earlier period during their courtship. When I first began to show battered women this cycle, they said to me, "You have it just a little bit wrong. You've left out the first part of the relationship, the courtship period." And during that period, that's when the man is very good to her. He's kind, he's gentle, he's nurturing, he listens to her, and he really does try to understand her needs. And that's the point at which she falls in love with him. And she believes that that's the real man. And these other two parts of the cycle, the mean parts, the tension building and the acute battering incident, most battered women view as an appendage. And they think if only they can do something better, only they can find a way to calm him down, make him feel better, protect him somewhat, then the mean part will drop out and they'll be left with that first part of the man that they fell in love with. And of course, the research has now shown that there aren't really two sides to this man, that they're very much integrated and that both parts are present, and that the mean part takes over and becomes bigger and bigger, while the loving contrition part, or the loving part, becomes smaller. Okay, the first chart was just sort of a generic battering incident. But here I've graphed what battering incidents look like when a woman reaches the point of desperation where she believes that she may have to stop him using force that ends up killing him. When I first made this chart, I labeled the amount of tension as a 0 to a 10. And I found that at about level 8, it comes a danger zone, where most battered women, if the incident reaches that level in their perception, that's the point at which they believe that he could kill them, that they could die in that relationship. Now, the third incident that I graphed on this chart is so severe that the woman no longer perceives that there's even a respite, that the violence comes down to the no violence level. It stays up at that danger level. These are the cases where some women actually perceive danger even when the man is sleeping, or perceive danger so that they can't do anything about it and may seek assistance to have him killed and hiring killers. And the reason that that also can be considered imminent danger for those women is because they perceive at all times he could kill them.
It is this perception of being constantly in danger from the betterer that is at the heart of the battered women's defense, whether or not there is apparent premeditation. Dr. Lenore Walker.
Some women actually say to people, I'd like to kill him, or, you know, if he does it again, I'm going to kill him. We've had some real incidents where women have talked about being angry enough to kill while they've been in shelter, and with some of the close relationships that shelters around the country have had with prosecutors' offices, they manage to get those records and then use it against the woman as though she couldn't possibly have been a battered woman or that it was premeditated. But my research showed that 86% of the women said that they could have killed him and thought about the man being dead at some point. I mean, very few women do kill, and in fact, there's a decrease in the number of women who are killed and an increase in the number of women who are being killed in this country. But if indeed 86% wished him dead at some point, that tells us that just thinking it or saying it isn't going to really impact on whether she does it or not.
Dr. Walker served on an advisory panel to update the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, published by the American Psychiatric Association. This book lists all the official diagnoses accepted by insurance companies or government agencies. Walker says she tried and failed to get battered women syndrome listed as a distinct diagnosis. It is now recognized as a subcategory of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Think about what happens to people when they're really very scared that they're going to be hurt. Most people have what we call a fight or a flight response. And then particularly if we do it on a repeated basis, they change the way someone thinks or our cognitive area. And those changes in battered women also affect her memory. And there are two major ways that her memory is affected. One is that at certain moments when her concentration is so intense on protecting herself, she blocks or minimizes and denies what is happening. Second, intrusive memories, re-experiencing the trauma again and again in one's mind, that re-exposes a battered woman to the repeated violence. And there are four specific ways that the DSM says it could happen. The first is that it just pops into your mind without any stimulus. You just are sitting there and all of a sudden you begin to think about what has happened to you before. The second is in your dreams. And many battered women have sleep problems because as they begin to dream, they begin to dream about the abusive incidents and they get scared and wake themselves up. The third is not just now thinking about it, but also believing that it's happening all over again in your mind. So even though you're not really experiencing the attack, in your mind, the battered woman believes that it's happening again. And they tell you in the DSM how you can measure that. There are a number of ways that that can happen psychologically. Sometimes it's simply a sense of reliving without having any kind of verbal knowledge, but just that feeling, the same feelings that were there, having those same scary feelings again. They also talk about some psychotic-like symptoms. So somebody could also be psychotic and have battered woman syndrome, and that might be through hallucinations or illusions or delusions that could be a re-experiencing of the trauma. The third way they talk about is dissociative experiences or flashbacks. And many of us are aware of what happens to Vietnam veterans when they had flashbacks. They could be standing in the middle of the street and have some greenery around them and then hear a helicopter, and they can all of a sudden be transported just by the sound of the helicopter and the sight of the trees back to the jungle again and feel the feelings that they felt at that moment. Well, that's what happens to many battered women, that when another battering incident starts to happen, they begin to get fragments of other battering incidents that have happened before, and that increases the perception of danger in their mind at the moment of this next battering incident. Now, sometimes they have what we call a dissociative disorder, and that means a separation of their mind from their body, where they actually almost are on automatic pilot, and it becomes simply an instinctive reaction that they have because they're so scared. And then the fourth way is that there's intense psychological distress at symbolic kinds of events. For example, a rape victim who's been raped in a parking lot may end up driving by that parking lot and beginning to get flashbacks and psychological distress, a panic attack perhaps, as she drives by remembering what happened to her. So those are the four ways. To make the diagnosis, you only need one out of four for a post-traumatic stress disorder. But in fact, in most cases of battered woman syndrome, particularly those where the woman is scared to death that she's going to be killed, you have more than one. Now, the third criteria is the avoidance stimuli. And those are all the things, there are seven of them, and they're all the things that happen to a woman when she tries to withdraw or minimize or deny what has happened to her.
You have just heard excerpts from testimony in a mock trial of a battered woman who killed her husband. In a real trial, the testimony would take many hours and relate each point of the case to a point in the theory of battered women syndrome. Usually, the prosecutor challenges each point of the testimony to try to keep it from being introduced. Furthermore, the testimony may have to convince a jury who don't think the accused looks or acts the way they imagine is appropriate for a victim.
Every time we say, "Why didn't she leave?" we lose perspective that leaving doesn't stop the violence, that men continue to harass women, stalk them, follow them, and kill them in some cases, and that judges in divorce courts are awarding joint custody, which places mothers in greater danger and children in danger, or actual custody to abusive fathers. Even if they don't physically abuse these children, the power and control needs do affect the ability to parent those children properly. And so we've got a long way to go in protecting battered women.
Dr. Lenore Walker, a forensic and clinical psychologist who testifies on behalf of battered women who killed their husbands in self-defense. Her offices are in Denver, Colorado. Her ninth book is titled Terrifying Love, Why Battered Women Kill and How Society Responds. Reporting for Wings, I'm Frieda Worden.
This program first aired on Wings in 1992. As of 2015, some law schools teach the battered woman syndrome, but many courts do not admit evidence of abuse into trials of women who kill abusers. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose website is gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.